Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the new, improved Santa Monica Live Show Dome. First of all, news of Nice Corp, nice people doing nice things. Very nice indeed. A former British police sergeant has been sentenced to 10 months in jail for trying to sell details about a celebrity couple's daughter and other confidential information to the Sun newspaper owned by Rupert. What's it? Rupert. I'll think of it. James Bowers was sentenced a week ago after pleading guilty to misconduct in public office. That being the police. Prosecutors said he presented or passed information about three incidents, one involving the two-year-old daughter of model Katie Price, who? And singer Peter Andre, who? To the Rupert Murdoch, who owned Tabloid. The 30-year-old cop, ex-cop, was arrested as part of the investigation into police corruption, which, as this host of this program has insisted, is the real essence of the scandal over there. Maybe to come over here. Who knows? We import all their funny words, not phone hacking. The inquiry is running alongside investigations into phone and computer hacking. Blah, blah, blah. About 20 people have been charged in the scandal, including journalists, police officers, and former Murdoch executives. Well, that would be about everybody. And it's all so nice. Nice people doing nice things. Nice Corp. Now, new to the godly, Roman Catholic priests who are sex abusers are being paid to handle prayer requests from unsuspecting families. That's actually nice, too. For centuries, the Catholic faithful have arranged masses for sick relatives, deceased loved ones, or in the memory of friends. They're called intentions, and usually Catholics offer a small donation. A Chicago television station, WLS-TV, has discovered some intentions are being farmed out to priests who are sex offenders. Men banned from regular ministry, now paid to pray, and some of the faithful are not informed. Father Donald O'Connor was cashiered in 2002. He was terminated as pastor of Assumption Parish in Coal City near Chicago. Newly obtained records from the Diocese of Joliet revealed church findings that O'Connor had sexually abused many boys in numerous parishes. Why stick with one? It's the variety that counts. The priest was quoted once as saying, quote, "It's better than shacking up with a woman," unquote. One of the victims committed suicide, according to the diocese files. But just 1 month after O'Connor was permanently removed from any public ministry, he was sent a letter from the diocese chancellor asking if he was, quote, "in need of mass stipends, just let us know the number you would need, and a check will be issued every 3 months," unquote. Another quote, "Why on earth are church officials coddling and being concerned about giving enough money to sexual predators instead of getting those sexual predators indicted and jailed?" asks Barbara Blaine of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. The pay-to-pray benefits continue to this day, allowed by canon law, according to a statement from the Joliet Diocese. Quote, "Like all priests, they," predator priests, "may offer a mass for a specific person or cause, and they may receive the small amount of a stipend if one is offered, usually $10. The payments to Father O'Connor show the priest abuser handled hundreds of families' mass intentions and was paid thousands of dollars before he died, despite being officially, quote, removed from ministry. There is no evidence in the records of the diocese that any parishioners were ever notified until they heard about it here on Hello, Welcome to the Show.
Until my luck runs out,
cold, pendulum swings. Thought you knew everything. If my hands made the cross, sinner, I have never learned. Beginner, I cannot return. Forever, I must walk this earth like some forgotten soldier. But these things I should keep to myself. But I feel somehow strangely compelled. Under moonlight I stood wild and naked. I felt no shame, just my spirit awakened. Sinner, seeing everything got in my eyes, got my face. Fireball drop from the sky. All my dreams have come to pass. Where's my faith? Is it lost? I can't see it till I cast it off. Sinner, there is no such thing. Beginner, I have learned to sing. Forever, I must walk this earth like some forgotten soldier.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, now possibly to be arrayed in garments from Abercrombie & Fitch. We'll find out about that later in this broadcast. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. This from American Banker. Three guesses what that's the trade magazine for. That's right, Canadian bankers. You're very good. Wells and Citibank halt most foreclosure sales as the Office of Comptroller of the Currency ratchets up security. I will read that for you. Wells Fargo and Citigroup have halted the vast majority of their foreclosure sales in multiple states following the release of new guidance by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. This abrupt showdown came in response to the OCC's April release of minimum standards for foreclosures. Actually, for the sales, which are the final act in the foreclosure process, the Federal Reserve issued identical guidelines, making the guidelines universal for the industry. The Fed oversees, I think, the biggest banks, or the littlest banks, or the ones in between. Within 2 weeks of the release of the guidance, Wells, Citi, and J.P. Morgan Chase all but stopped foreclosure sales, which are usually the point of no return in the foreclosure process. J.P. Morgan Chase has since resumed its normal volume. The halt is most dramatic with Wells, the nation's largest mortgage originator. The bank's foreclosure sales in five western states dropped from as many as 349 a day in April to fewer than 10 a day across the entire region. A spokeswoman for Citi said the bank is, quote, in the process of complying and following the directive. The OCC acknowledged that some banks had drastically cut back in foreclosure sales. It declined to say if the April guidance was a result of new perceived shortcomings in the industry. Says agency spokesman Brian Hubbard, if servicers are not certain they're meeting these new standards, pausing foreclosures is a responsible and productive step. New foreclosure filings continue unabated, according to court records. It's not clear what, if any, specific concerns caused the banks to rein in sales, but the bank steps are an echo of the 2010 foreclosure halt. The robo-signing debacle was only the only other time we've had a similar event where a bank slowed down significantly, says an industry authority. The OCC guidance is significant because it applies to all regulated bank servicing rather than specific consent orders. Most of the requirements prepared in a list of 13 questions calling whoever wrote that song. Banks should ask themselves before selling a home are remedial. Question number one, for example, is, quote, is the loan's default status accurate? Question number five asks whether borrowers are protected from foreclosure by bankruptcy. Question number seven asks if the borrower is in an active trial loss mitigation plan or modification. Failure to comply with the guidance may result in unsafe and unsound banking practices, says the OCC. Neither Wells nor the OCC identified specific areas of concern for the bank, but Wells has faced scrutiny of its foreclosure handling, most recently from New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who alleged a month ago, or actually earlier this month, that Wells had, quote, flagrantly violated its obligations to homeowners under that 50-state mortgage servicing settlement, which was supposed to have solved all this. The Office of Comptroller of the Currency, roused from its long and energizing slumber. Something we wouldn't have known about, perhaps, had I not read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the new Iraq. There's been so much breast beating in the wake of the 10th anniversary of shock and awe. But here's somebody doing something else to his breast. Michael Knights in foreignpolicy.com reporting. And this echoes what we've been reading this week. As recently as Friday, 76, I think, casualties in attacks and bombings on Sunni targets following a wave of bombings of Shiite targets. Can I say that on the radio? Targets? Anyway, Michael Knights reports, in the latest bout of sectarian and ethnic bloodletting, coordinated bomb attacks ripped through Shiite neighborhoods in Baghdad and northern Iraq, killing more than 30 people. This, of course, was before the attacks on the Sunnis. The spasm of violence followed clashes between the Iraqi army and Sunni protesters and insurgents last month when the federal government temporarily lost control of some town centers and urban neighborhoods. Negative indicators abound in Iraq. Armed civilian militias are reactivating. Tit-for-tat bombings are targeting Sunni and Shiite mosques. Some Iraqi military forces are breaking down into ethnic sectarian components or suffering from chronic absenteeism. Numerous segments of Iraq's body politic, Kurdish, Sunni, Arab, and Shia, are exasperated over the government's inability to address political or economic inequities. They're talking seriously about partition. Hello, Joe Biden. In late April, the federal military miscalculated when it raided a protest site in the northern town of Hawija, and that turned into a bloody firefight with scores of civilians killed. This event has the potential, says Knights, to become an iconic rallying call for insurgent groups such as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, hello, and the neo-Ba'athist Naqshbandi movement. The resurgence of violence since 2010 is shown very clearly in the metrics used to gauge the strength of the insurgency. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy's Iraq Violence Database has tracked violence since 2004. In the first quarter of 2011, monthly attacks bottomed out at 358. By the first quarter of 2012, the average monthly attacks had risen to 539. By the first quarter of this year, 804. Anti-U.S. targeting has been replaced with Iraqi-on-Iraqi violence. Former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker views the current period as a return to the conditions of 2006 and 2007 when Iraq plunged into civil war-like violence. You think this has anything to do with the fact that the money that General David Petraeus paid the Sunnis to stop fighting has run out and the government jobs he promised them have failed to materialize? You think? The Iraqi government has tried to deflect blame for its own failing on the Syrian uprising, arguing it was suffering from the spillover of violence next door, but the upswing in violence cannot be ascribed solely to ancient Sunni-Shia hatreds. The embers of sectarianism were stoked back into life by the Baghdad government's unwillingness to meet demands for an end to the collective punishment of Sunnis for the crimes of the Saddam Hussein regime. That was, I think, a legacy of J. Paul Bremer, wasn't it? Anyway, Donald, in the wake of all this, or ignoring all this, Donald Rumsfeld is making the rounds again, flogging a new book. You remember him, don't you?
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. Here is a country that's being liberated. Stuff happens, and it's untidy, and freedom's untidy, and free people are free to make mistakes. As you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time.
The army? Calling Dr. Freud. Anyway, Donald Rumsfeld was on a public radio program this week talking about his new book, in which he outlines his rules for leadership.
Rumsfeld's rules, I started collecting because my mom was a school teacher, and I was a youngster, and if I didn't know the meaning of a word, she'd say, well, write it down and look it up. And then I started writing down various other thoughts and rules and ideas and anecdotes. And so I've always carried a 3x5 card, and I've got now, I think, close to 300 rules, and they're not all mine, obviously. They're from people a lot smarter than I am.
Oh, please. Nobody's smarter than you are. Here's proof.
We know what we know. We think we know what we don't know. But if we don't know what we don't know. Stuff happens. Our intel, it was bulletproof. We had the bullets, just not the proof. Our bullets, they proved what bullets prove. Stuff happens. Stuff happens. Looters got to loot. Stuff happens.
freedom can be untidy. For years, Iraq has been untidy. So why do you hate their freedom? Stuff happens. You fight with the army you have. Otherwise, you'd need another army. The army we had was the one we had. Stuff happens. The dead enders, they just refuse to die. They haven't thrown the final throws yet. We're in there until we leave. Stuff happens. Stuff happens. It happens every day. Stuff happens. If you're in the way, thank the USA. The unknowable, it can't be known. The unshowable just will not be shown. I rented this war I didn't own. Say it again, girls. Take me home now. Stuff happens.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the war, won't you? It won an award way long ago.
Soft, listen to the war. We can listen to the war.
Coral reefs are in decline, but their collapse can still be avoided with local and global action. That's according to findings reported in the journal Current Biology, based on an analysis that combines the latest science on reef dynamics with the latest climate models. They're so thin, those climate models. Quote, people benefit by reefs having a complex structure, a little like a Manhattan skyline, but underwater. Don't tempt me, says Peter Mumby of the University of Queensland and University of Exeter. Structurally complex reefs provide nooks and crannies for thousands of species, providing the habitat needed to sustain productive reef fisheries. To predict the reef's future, the researchers spent 2 years constructing a computer model of how reefs work. Building on hundreds of studies conducted over the last 40 years, they then combined their reef model with climate models to make predictions about the balance between forces that will allow reefs to continue to grow and those that, such as hurricanes and erosion, that will shrink them. Ideally, said the researcher, the goal is a carbonate budget that remains in the black for the next century at least. Such a future is possible, the researcher's model shows, but only with effective local protection and assertive action on greenhouse gases. Business as usual, he says, isn't going to cut it. But it's usual. The future of a globally warmed world has been revealed in a remote meteorite crater in Siberia, where lake sediments recorded the strikingly balmy climate of the Arctic during the last period, when greenhouse gas levels were as high as today, according to the Guardian newspaper. Unchecked burning of fossil fuels has driven carbon dioxide to levels not seen for 3 million years, when, according to the sediments, temperatures were 8 degrees centigrade higher than today, lush forests covered the tundra, and sea levels were up to 40 meters higher than today. It's like deja vu, said Professor Julie Brigham Grete of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who led the new research analyzing a core of sediment to see what temperatures in the region were like between 3.6 and 2.2 million years ago. We have seen these warm periods before. Many people now agree this is where we are heading. It shows a huge warm... The sediments have been slowly settling in Lake... Oh, I can't pronounce the name of that lake. Enough of that story. Extra cloud cover caused by emissions of industrial pollutants is known to reduce the effects of global warming, but its impact in reducing temperatures has been overestimated in the climate models, according to new research. This is particularly significant for China and India because it's been believed these two giant countries would be partly shielded from the effects of climate change by their own heavy industrial pollution. But au contraire, says the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Germany. The Institute's study looked at the behavior of sulfate particles in the air created by the reaction of oxygen with sulfur dioxide released from factory chimneys and other sources of pollution. In humid condition, the sulfates attract water droplets and form clouds. This increase in the cloud cover reflects more sunlight back into space and so cools the Earth. But the Planck researchers went to study a cloud formed at the top of a mountain, taking samples at various times to see how the sulfates reacted. What was crucial was how they were formed in the first place. Current climate models assumed hydrogen peroxide and ozone have a large role in creating the sulfates, but new research shows the catalysts for the chemical reaction are more likely to be metal ions like iron, manganese, titanium, or chromium. The key factor is all of these are heavier than hydrogen peroxide and ozone, so they are more likely to fall out of the cloud through the pull of gravity, thus considerably reducing the cooling effect of the original pollution. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, blame gravity. We're working on that. Deadline Cancun, Mexico. Researchers taking a new look at the snow and ice covering Mount Everest and the national park that surrounds it are finding abundant evidence that the world's tallest peak is shedding its frozen cloak. The scientists have also been studying temperature and precipitation trends in the area, found that the Everest region has been warming. Snowfall has been declining since the early 1990s. This according to the American Geophysical Union. Glaciers in the Mount Everest region have shrunk by 13% in the last 50 years. The snow line has shifted upward by 180 meters. Makes it easier to climb. Hey, I could do it now. Because it's not there. Glaciers smaller than 1 square kilometer are disappearing the fastest and have experienced a 43% decrease in surface area since the 1960s. The glaciers are melting faster than they're replenished by ice and snow. They're revealing rocks and debris that were previously hidden deep under the ice. Maybe there's gold there. The researchers suspect the decline of snow and ice in the Everest region is from human-generated greenhouse gases. However, they've not yet established a firm connection between the mountain's changes and climate change. So hold your horses. More than half of common plant species and a third of animals could see a serious decline in their habitat range because of climate change. New research, according to the BBC, reporting on a journal article in Nature Climate Change, suggests biodiversity around the globe will be significantly impacted if temperatures rise more than 2 degrees centigrade. An international team of researchers looked at the impacts of rising temperatures on nearly 50,000 common species of plants and animals. They projected if no significant efforts were made to limit greenhouse gas emissions, 2100 global temperatures would be 4 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. In that model, some 34% of animal species and 57% of plants would lose more than half of their current habitat ranges. Time to adapt, kids. Or not. Global warming is changing the location of Earth's geographic poles, according to a new study in Geophysical Research Letters. Researchers at the University of Texas, Austin, report that increased melting of the Greenland ice sheet and, to a lesser degree, ice loss in other parts of the globe helped to shift the North Pole several centimeters east each year since 2005. A big change, says the lead author, who is a geophysicist. From 1982 to 2005, the pole drifted southeast toward northern Labrador. I love Labradors. At a rate of about 2 millarcseconds, roughly 6 centimeters per year. But in 2005, the pole changed course and began galloping east towards Greenland. Well, who wouldn't? At a rate of more than 7 millarcseconds per year. Scientists have known for a long time locations of Earth's geographic poles aren't fixed. But they aren't broken. Over the course of the year, they shift seasonally as the Earth's distributions of snow, rain, and humidity change. Usually the shift is circular with a wobble, says the author. But underlying the seasonal motion is a yearly motion that's thought to be driven in part by continental drift. Anyway, the lack of ice has affected that. And Deadline Oslo, a melt of ice on Greenland and Antarctica is expected to be less severe than expected this century, limiting sea level rise to a maximum of 27 inches, according to an international study released Tuesday. This is Reuters reporting on that. Even so, such a rise could dramatically change coastal environments in the lifetimes of people born today. So don't be born today. Be born yesterday. Don't you see? Some scientific studies have projected sea level rise of up to 2 meters by 2100. But Ice to Sea, a four-year project to narrow down uncertainties of how melting ice will pour water into the oceans, found that sea levels would rise by between 16.5 and 69 centimeters under a scenario of moderate global warming in this century. This is good news for those who have feared sharper rises, says David Vaughan of the British Antarctic Survey, who led the Ice to Sea project. But 69 centimeters is a very real impact. It changes the frequency of floods significantly, he said, and seas would keep rising for centuries beyond 2100, and a threat to coastal cities and low-lying islands, such as Tuvalu, owner of the TV.tv domain. Ice to Sea said a thaw of Antarctica, Greenland, and glaciers from the Alps to the Andes would contribute between 3.5 and 36.8 centimeters to sea level rise this century. Some other scientists disputed their projections. I think the numbers are too low, said Dorth Dahl Jensen, an ice expert and professor at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. She said Ice to Sea wrongly assumed a slowdown in the rate of ice discharge from Greenland. Ice to Sea says warmer temperatures will result in more snow over Antarctica, especially locking in the moisture on land. It played down worries of a runaway melt of Greenland and of the breakup of major Antarctic ice shelves. That's what passes for good news of the warm, copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
My brother Jake, oh my brother, From CPR, Continental Public Radio, the President's Weekly Address. Now, speaking from deep inside the White House, the President.
You know, Washington, D.C. is a funny town. Lots of good Americans come here to do the people's business, to try to deal with the country's problems, and to do their best to solve them. And then, there are the Republicans. Rather than roll up their sleeves and work together to make our economy even stronger, to make our banks even bigger, and to make our country even safer from the ever-present threat of the possibility of terrorism, some Republicans, not all of them, just want to whip up any suspicion of wrongdoing into a firestorm of scandal. They've done it before. And now, to quote one of their greatest presidents, there they go again. This week, we've heard scandal-mongering once again replace adult discussion of the need to reach a grand or even just a great bargain on budget and debt issues. Our Republican friends are beginning to confirm our worst suspicions, that they're not really our friends. Accusations are flying that somehow I must have known about or even approved of rogue personnel in the IRS acting totally irresponsibly, that I must have been manipulating our understanding of the complex and chaotic situation in Benghazi, or that I somehow sent stormtroopers goose-stepping into the offices of the Associated Press. Well, I don't know those IRS officials, and I certainly don't know all the people involved in the Benghazi situation. But I can tell you this. After 4+ years, I know our Homeland Security folks pretty darn well. And the one thing they don't do is goose-step, especially in offices. In each of these cases, there are sets of facts that can and will be known. And that will be the time for accountability for whoever did whatever wrong. But the American people sent us here to look forward, not backward. If I'd known our Republican friends were going to be so dedicated to finger-pointing, I'd never have decided not to investigate charges of torture in the previous administration. So, in the weeks and months ahead, we'll cooperate with responsible investigations, and we'll provide whatever information we have in a manner that protects the national interest as you have elected us to define it. But we've got a lot of work to do to help our middle class prosper, to help our financial sector thrive, to help the right side in Syria as soon as we can determine what side that is, and to solve our fiscal problems once and for all, at least until next year. I hope I can count on you to remind our Republican friends that constantly looking in the rearview mirror is no way to drive. Have a good week.
Funds for this program came from the John and Dolly Herzog Foundation for coverage of issues the Herzogs like. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addy the atom?
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Spinning like a happy top.
Spinning like a happy top?
Yes, sir.
Why? Because it's warm and sunny here in Southern California?
No, because there's a big fun run today, and I love fun runs.
And Adam loves fun runs. Interesting. After three... I won't even get into it.
Speed. We love speed.
After three unplanned nuclear reactor shutdowns, federal regulators say they are stepping up oversight of Florida Power and Light's Turkey Point facility. Why do you think they call... The Nuclear Regulatory Commission stressed Thursday there's no threat to the public from the shutdowns of Unit 3, one of two reactors at Turkey Point. Unit 3, one of two reactors. Already, I'm worried. It's been shut down three times in February and March. The shutdowns involved problems with the unit's condenser, turbine, and pumps, not the central radioactive core. Overall, the Turkey Point plant continues to operate safely, says NRC's regional administrator. However, these shutdowns point to potential performance issues, and we want to ensure that the company addresses them appropriately. Guys, I'd always worry when a spokeswoman talks about performance issues, but that's just me. The failure of a 600-pound valve named 7466 is at the heart of a major inspection going on this week at Brown's Ferry Nuclear Plant by inspectors with the NRC. The review is one of the most intense reviews NRC conducts. It was prompted by a serious red flag safety violation at the plant issued in October 2010. It was the first red flag for Tennessee Valley Authority. NRC inspectors discovered the valve on the low power cooling system for the Unit 1 reactor was inoperable and had gone unnoticed for 18 months.
Hey, these things happen.
The valve is a key component in Unit 1's fire suppression plan.
Fires don't happen in nuclear plants.
It allows water to get to the reactor or to the suppression pool to suppress steam. The faulty valve was noticed for the first time during shutdown for refueling. It had not been operational since the last shutdown for refueling in March 2009. Of all the valves to fail, that is probably one of the most significant in the fire suppression plan, says the NRC's deputy director for the Division of Reactors, Region 2. A team of NRC inspectors investigated further and determined there were inadequate safety procedures at the plant, said the inspector. We determined it to be a condition of very high significance.
That's only one inspector's opinion.
True. Dateline Wichita, federal regulators have ruled in favor of an engineer fired for reporting unsafe conditions created by a contractor at a nuclear power plant in eastern Kansas. OSHA also found Enercon Services of Kennesaw, Georgia, terminated him in retaliation for alerting superiors to the safety issues and refusing to comply with the supervisor's demand that he sign off on an engineering plan that justified unsafe remedial actions. He's been reinstated with back pay. And they've been ordered to pay him, the engineering firm, $50,650 in damages.
Chump change.
A nuclear plant near North Carolina's capital city was shut down after operators reviewing ultrasonic tests from last year found the results showing tiny marks of corrosion and cracking that need repair, according to the NRC.
Everything cracks.
Operators at Sheeran-Harris plant near Raleigh found a quarter-inch flaw in the covering of the reactor vessel, which contains superheated steam produced by the nuclear reactor's energy. The crack did not penetrate the vessel head, and there is no evidence of radiation leakage, according to the NRC. The discovery, say it with me, did not affect the health and safety of employees or the public at the plant.
So what? It's a big so what. It's nothing bigger. And we love this, especially with cheese.
Deadline Omaha, the utility that owns the troubled Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant in eastern Nebraska, says it hopes to have the plant ready to operate by summer. Federal regulators reported Friday it still has hundreds of issues to correct before it can reopen. Last month, Omaha Power District officials said they expected to have the plant ready by late May, but the NRC Regulators said the plant met only 8 of 25 major performance issues. All 8 had to do with worker performance in areas such as safety and organization. That means concerns about the physical condition of the plant and its equipment, such as the replacement of faulty electrical wire insulation, overhauling of structural supports inside the building that houses the reactor and safeguards against flooding, had not been allayed during comprehensive federal inspections in March.
These things happen. Yeah, they do.
A team of experts at the Nuclear Regulation Authority in Japan, this is from the Japan Times, said in its latest draft report, it has confirmed that some crush zones beneath Higashidori nuclear power plant are active faults. Company officials reiterated the company's view that the zones are not active faults.
I believe the company.
Not the experts.
That's right.
And France has started a public inquiry into a plan to build a nuclear waste repository to be buried half a kilometer under the northeastern countryside. If approved, the CIGEO project will store highly radioactive waste from France's 58 reactors. The company spearheading the plan wants to start construction in 2019, begin operations in 2025. The facility will cost $17.4 billion for construction and operation over 100 years. The inquiry is a masquerade and pure exercise in public relations, says the anti-nuclear group Sortir du Nucléaire. No one can guarantee the safety of the site for such a long period, it says. The French nuclear firm EDF now stores waste at reactor sites and at above-ground facilities. Sweden and Finland are also developing deep repositories. And Finland had an entry in the Eurovision Song Contest, a guy who sang like a soprano. So we know they can do deep repositories. Under French law, nuclear operators have to build portfolios or amass funds to pay for the decommissioning of reactors and radioactive waste storage. A parliamentary report published last year concluded operators may not be setting aside enough money. Cost estimates for the CIGEO site vary from 14.4 billion to 35 billion euros. That's at the current rate, just about that many dollars.
Cheap.
And clean and safe, too safe to meter, our friend, the atom. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. First, for those of you who remember back at the time of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the insistence on the part of spokespeople for BP and other folks that BP was no longer a British company. It had so many American shareholders, it was no longer a British, you know, it was ours more than theirs. This from the BBC this week. BP feels its financial recovery is in jeopardy because the compensation system in the wake of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is being abused. The financial burden of paying fictitious and inflated claims may even make BP a takeover target, it fears. BP hopes to get help from British Prime Minister David Cameron, who will raise the issue with the U.S. government. BBC's business editor says, according to BP sources, the rate at which cash is leaking from the company could turn into a serious new financial crisis for the company, putting at risk its dividend. Holy crap. And making it vulnerable to a takeover by another oil company. BP is so worried by the potential magnitude of alleged undeserved payments it is making to companies that it's planning to ask the UK Prime Minister and Chancellor for help in persuading the US government to intervene. Blimey, that sounds British. From the International Business Times, speaking of oil companies, the European Commission's antitrust authorities have carried out unannounced inspections at offices of at least 3 oil companies in 3 countries as part of a probe into suspicions of price fixing. BP, Royal Dutch Shell, and the pricing agency Platts all confirmed that their offices had been raided. The raids also included Norway's state oil company. The commission has concerns the companies may have colluded in reporting distorted prices to a price reporting agency, that would be Platts, not Plots. to manipulate the published prices for a number of oil and biofuel products, according to the commission. This is an analog to the banks fixing the LIBOR rate, another benchmark for trades and prices all over the world. Competition authorities are also investigating if the oil giants prevented other companies from participating in the price assessment process in efforts to distort published prices. All of the companies say they're cooperating with the investigation. Several companies may have participated in anti-competitive agreements, says the head of the Norwegian oil company. In addition, the inspection is about the potential abuse of a dominant position by another company. Commission officials are investigating prices provided to Platts. The world's leading oil pricing agency's parent company, McGraw-Hill, produces information and benchmark price assessments for energy markets. This forms the basis of billions of dollars worth of oil sales around the world, which, of course, affects the price of food and other commodities as you go along through the chain of commerce. Even small distortions of assessed prices may have a huge impact on the prices of crude oil, refined oil products, and biofuels purchases and sales, potentially harming final consumers, according to the commission. The unannounced inspections are a preliminary step to investigate suspected anti-competitive practices. Oil companies fixing prices. Now I've heard everything. And from The Guardian, remember the guy who was poisoned? The Russian guy was poisoned in London 4 or 5 years ago. Polonium was found in his system. Very rare, nasty little radioactive substance. His name was Alexander Litvinenko. Now his widow has launched a blistering attack on the very same David Cameron and his associate, his cabinet member William Hague, accusing them of sabotaging the inquest into her husband's murder and hiding the Russian government's role in his death. Marina Litvinenko said she was utterly dismayed after a coroner on Friday upheld an application by Hague, cabinet member, I think foreign secretary, to keep crucial evidence from the inquest secret. The judge, Sir Robert Owen, any relation? Appeared reluctantly, agreed to exclude material which suggested Russia's state agencies were behind Litvinenko's Cold War-style killing. Judge Owen also agreed to suppress documents that examined whether UK officials could have done more to prevent his murder. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, we got everything we need. A furious Mrs. Litvinenko said on Friday the effect of the ruling is to protect those responsible for the murder of a British citizen on the streets of London and to allow the Russian government to shield behind a claim of secrecy made by William Hague with the backing of Prime Minister Cameron. She said there had been increasing signs over the past year that the government was moving to strike what she called a secret political deal with the Kremlin. In his ruling, the coroner said the secret evidence held by the British government does establish, quote, a prima facie case as to the culpability of the Russian state in Mr. Litvinenko's death, unquote. This evidence will now not be revealed. The judge made clear his unhappiness with the situation and admitted it made it difficult for him to carry out the full, frank, and fearless investigation that he originally promised. What do the British stand to gain from the Russians? By the way, just FYI, the Financial Times reported this week that the leading source of funds and arms for the Syrian rebels is the government of Qatar. That nation has a huge supply of natural gas. Europe currently buys its natural gas from Russia. Hey, I'm just giving you dots. You can connect them. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, following the dollar, after opening more than 15,000 branches across the United States in the decade leading up to the financial crisis, banks are retreating from lower-income neighborhoods, according to Business Week, even as the industry posted its second most profitable year on record. Lenders have closed more than 1,800 branches since late 2008, 93% of them in zip codes where the household income is below the national median. The decline limits access to basic financial services for people who don't have bank accounts and forces them to pay fees for such activities as cashing checks and settling utility bills. Just a nutty coincidence. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this weekend's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time. Over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz, shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internets at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through iTunes, Sideshow Network, and KCRW.com. And it would be just like the banks closing their branches in all neighborhoods non-discriminatorily. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. That is to say, you can read the meanderings of the host thereof on Twitter. More than 86,000 people do at the Harry Shearer. The email address for this broadcast and the list of the music heard here on and some fabulous stuff in the store, available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network. So long from Santa Monica.